Judy's got there first. Mm. He read a book. She remembered the book, the name she mentioned. And he was very interested in this book, and that got him going to communist or international socialist league meetings. And she came in afterwards, this is how she put it. Mm-hmm. But can I ask a slightly psychological question? Given that you know the sort of family Ruth had, a very powerful mother, a very gentle father.
I didn't know them well. I mean, that was my impression.
That's the impression that I've got talking to people also. What sort of problems would Ruth have had growing up? And how, I mean, perhaps that's putting it very crudely. What sort of struggles would she have had to have had? The need to liberate herself from her mother, or is this not a good line of discussion, really?
I'm sure it's something interesting to investigate if one were writing, you know, about her. But I don't have enough information to do more than speculate.
Mm. Well, I'm not talking about her particularly. I'm saying, I mean, in general, or is there no such in general cases of that sort of thing?
No. I would say in general that if it... I mean, in a way, you and I have similar sort of family setups. Yeah. We both have dominating mothers and more gentle fathers and passive fathers, yes.
Mm. What's the effect of that been on you?
What do you think?
On me, personally. I don't think I'm like Ruth. The effect hasn't been, you know, the same in a sense. You know, there may be a sense of insecurity about intimate personal relationships.
I think there's some lack of trust of the man to really
caution,
be there for one.
That, yeah,
some wariness of the man.
A sense of wariness.
To really be there for one.
You mean not having the father figure?
To be being strong for one.
Some sort of
protector. I suppose.
For a man who will be
strong.
He will be strong, he will be there. I mean, in a way.
I'll close it up.
I mean, I think that. You know, Ruth's mother was much more there for her than her father, and I think in some ways, Joe wasn't there for her.
Mm.
She was the one who
had to be there.
Who was mother and father very often.
For herself, isn't it? About the children. I mean, there's a whole other thing about the kids and their relationship. Do you? Because there's this image that people have of Ruth that she wasn't all that good at mothering because she was so involved in the movement and in her work. You know, but then that is partly because, you know, people always judged that the mother, you know, they were very conventional ideas.
Was she good at fathering?
I don't know. I didn't see her with the children all that much. I had once had a long conversation with her about her teenage children and her children's emerging sexuality, and I was, you know, quite anxious about my children. This was in England, and she described how she's a very modern mother in a sense and quite supportive of her children, and said, well, you know, when you decide, here's the pill, and there's just a few rules, you know, she sort of sketched them out, and her daughter's boyfriend, she was only 15 and she had a steady boyfriend, and Ruth actually wasn't all that happy. So She felt that she was very young, you know, to have a steady relationship for 2 years, this boyfriend was with her.
Do you know anything about her children? Do you know anything about...
I know as much as one can know talking to people here. I'm going to talk to them.
What do you know? What do you know about the kids?
They feel as though they sort of bounced around between Tilly and the family. Mm-hmm. And that they probably had quite a hard upbringing because mm-hmm. the parents were away.
Mm-hmm.
They were politically involved. And judging from Sean's film, mm-hmm. One gets a feeling of anger
mm-hmm.
Against her parents. Although she resolves it in the film, in a way. I understand. So...
And do you know anything about the other girls and their lives?
No, not really. Mm. I'm going to ask them. If they'll tell me, I don't know. What should I know? What should I know about them?
You ask. It's interesting. I mean, if you want an autobiography of Ruth, I think you'll find it interesting to hear about
them. There's a sense of that problem all the way along. I think the kids had a damn hard time, is the sense I get.
But to a certain extent, this is true of the children of nearly all the political activists of that generation. And Schoenbrookers and
enormous problem.
The most together person who's kind of emerged from it that I know, of course there's a whole range of the Bernsteins, etc., is Sheila, funnily enough. No, but she's actually, in some, she's worked through some things in herself.
Yes.
But anyway, we're not discussing other people, and one feels a bit uneasy, you know, talking with the tape about other people's intimate lives, especially when one, it's all semi-speculation on my part. I mean, he really knew the kids better. And I know, I mean, I've heard so much about the girls and some of the problems and issues. But, you know, you'll probably get a much better perspective when you get to talk to them.
Lee Heyman was saying, isn't it strange on that white CP members, of all the CP members, so few of the children stayed in the movement?
I think it makes a hell of a lot of sense. In the sense that the children need to create a life that's, you know, of normality because they're going to be deprived of it.
I can't think of any.
Sheila.
Ruth and Brian and Sheila.
Ruth?
First.
And who else?
Brian Bunting.
Yes, and Dennis Gilbert.
And Dennis Gilbert.
Were his parents.
Mm-hmm. His father. Mm-hmm. And his mother.
But relatively few is what
he's saying. But not their children.
The other children of the Naidu family, there's 4 generations of them.
No, that's what he was saying. Within the black and the Indian communities, it tends to be a family affair.
Yes, well, I mean, that's supposed to be obvious explanation.
Mm. But that first generation were not really active. I mean, they were kind of inspirations.
Or more intellectually, socialist in an intellectual sense.
People in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, I mean, but the children of Ruth and
that generation.
And in fact, I think the most, you know.
Sure. What about, is it Robin or Jill who's very active in the feminist movement?
Robin.
Well, I mean, in that sense, she's taken up a cause.
Yes, but that she, I mean, not such a fight on it.
Oh, yeah. No.
But of course, the 30s were a very difficult period, whereas the 50s, the sort of mid 40s to 50s, the political struggle around them was opening up as well. One gets a feeling it might have been easy to be political. Certainly the Communist Party in the 30s was in a very dead phase. Sort of repressive Comintern policies being pushed down.
No, that's why I think it did get quite intellectual. They'd have debating societies and discuss theory and have reading groups, etc., in the 30s. And of course, it does start to happen in the 40s when you get this massively rapid urbanization. Of course, the 20s were quite active with the ICU and the whole passionate discussion of which direction the Communist Party was going to take, whether it was going to concentrate on black peasants and workers as opposed to
and then white, came the black republic.
White workers and the Black Republic slogan. But then, of course, there was the consequence of that decision.
Yes, that divided the party.
And the purges and so on. So, yeah, the 40s, from mid-40s into the 50s, there were kind of clear-cut struggles.
I wonder if... I asked Tilly if she ever talked to the children about politics. And she said, not that she can think of, particularly.
So we need to.
So I said, well, what were the friends? What sort of friends did you have? She said, I wouldn't have friends unless they were political. I mean, people who weren't political were a waste of time. I only had political friends in the house. And she didn't have a sense of talking to the children. She didn't remember what their rooms looked like at all. It might have been to do with her memory, but it might have been to do with who Tilly was herself. I said, what pictures? She said, pictures. Well, you know, what do the rooms look like? Bed, wardrobe. There was no... She didn't have a strong memory of family... Of children, she didn't give me the sense of having spent a lot of time putting the children's rooms together. It may just be recent memory dropout, but her memory of other things around that period was quite good. But one also gets the feeling that only politics was, I mean, politics was the major issue in that household all the time.
But was she an activist?
Tilly. Yes, I think so. She was very active in the women's support group for the party, which was mainly involved in raising funds. And she was taking up issue politics.
Is this in the 30s and 40s?
Yeah. Miriam went on quite a few meetings and on sprees and all sorts of things. They had quite a chat about the fun they'd had at various meetings. Things like support for China in the war, support for the Soviet Union. I think Friends of the Soviet Union, but that came a bit later.
But I would have thought that being politically more linked to the Soviet Union than to South African issues. No?
Probably.
I mean, this is just the feeling that I have of that generation of people.
But it's true. I mean, the party in the 30s was, I think, more Soviet-oriented. They'd kind of lost us as the South African base.
They'd lost Bunting. They'd lost Roo. They'd lost all the people who were pushing for a South African party.
Yes.
And they were going for a popular front.
And many of the members
support for the Soviet Union
were not South Africans, spent it. The formative years of their lives abroad in Eastern Europe. So I think those were factors,
Difficult to find out how somebody grows up.
What school did Ruth go to?
She went to a little primary school which Tilly couldn't remember. And then
say Miriam remembers her standard five.
No, Esther. She was at the Jewish government school in standard 5, and then she went to quite a well-known school.
Didn't she go to GP?
I think so. GP Girls, huh? Yes. And she matriculated there. I got her records from the university. Two firsts and three seconds for her degree. It took 5 years to do her degree.
Because she kept on going off to youth congresses and things.
Was she going off to Russia at that stage as well?
I think so.
Because She took about 12 or 14 courses.
Good.
An extraordinary number.
Mm.
And then after that did a librarianship degree. Mm.
But that was much later.
Mm. That was in the 60s.
Yeah, it was after she was banned.
Mm.
Mm. I was trying to fill in. That's something to do.
Her letter to the university is very interesting. She's got three children to support. She's clearly not going to be able to work in any as a journalist, and she needs to enroll in librarianship so that she can support her family. It's sort of a sad letter in a way. That had, maybe she was pitching it to get the university on her side. I don't know. There is certainly a feeling of there's a sort of strange feeling of desolation about the letter. I think it was written when she was in detention, perhaps, or when Joe was overseas. I'm not sure about the dates. I've got to build up and sort of get a chronology of these things.
I think Joe wasn't here when she did that.
Really? She said she had three children to support. Yeah. Presumably he wasn't.
He wasn't.
No longer. But then are you saying that she intended to stay on? I sort of had that impression at the time.
I think that she might have toyed with that idea.
She was saying, I've got to have, I can't work as a journalist, and I've got to have, you know, skill. I remember saying this because she was at varsity. I mean, we were both mature students, you know. I mean, she was more mature than I was. But
what year are you talking
63.
About?
63 she was doing her library, or 60, well it was 63 that I was there and she was there. I don't know when she got her librarianship.
She didn't ever get it.
She didn't get it because it was interrupted by the detention.
That's when she became friendly with Barney in 63.
When did she actually leave? At the end of 63?
Mm.
Because there's
when
a letter
of...
Really? So she didn't know all that well before then?
No, it was after Joe went.
Barney went to a meeting when he was 16 and was absolutely overawed by this woman, and she was a phenomenon because she was married to an Indian, as he was told.
Woman. Oh, I see.
She wasn't, in fact. She was going out with Ishmael. Uh-huh. And he sort of knew her then in a way, he says. But there's this letter, there's several letters really pushing to get her degree to write her exams. And then a letter from London saying, sorry, I can't write them, I've gone. So it must have been towards the end of 63.
Mm. It's interesting that Barney, in a sense, was very much the gentle male, almost kind of mothering her. You know, they were talking about these role reversals.
Never talking politics, having a lot of fun, going to theatre.
Yeah.
Getting her head away from. I mean, I think he had a very close relationship with her afterwards.
He was very protective of her.
Mm. He said he loved her, didn't he?
Can I make some tea?
Yeah,
I think.
It's 10 o'clock. Well, you must. Don't you have a time limit?
Yeah, it's 10 o'clock.
Let me just put the kids. Take a minute. Do you want tea or coffee?
I won't have, thanks. I'll go soon. I won't have anything. I need to go soon. An awful lot of work to do. It's just hanging over me. So I don't know if you've learned anything new, but I suppose one needs to just have little pieces of information. It's an ongoing thing, isn't it?
The sense of who people are. It might not be hard factual evidence often, but it's feelings about where people might go. I mean, the stuff about Tilly is fascinating in the relationship between her and Joe. Difficult stuff to put into. Writing history through people is very difficult.
It is, because there's always that other input, you know, which is the individual input.
Mm.
And yet there's the social context.
Have you ever written history that way? Yeah. dynamic which is emerging, certainly as a journalist, is the one between which we get to embed into a conference on the media quite soon, is the one between the relationship of the journalist telling it like it is, and the party political person, almost a propagandist for the party, and the relationship, where does the individual stand in that one? That's a terribly difficult problem for a journalist. I sense, but I haven't yet found out proof that she fell foul of the party line on occasion by taking a hard-nosed, fairly individualistic position on the basis of what she found out.
I believe so. Again, it's just hearing others, and that was after she left South Africa, I thought.
Well, she had quite a good relationship with Martin Agassi, who would have been beyond the pale in party terms.
No, not at that stage. Remember, he was expelled much later, only a few years ago.
Really?
Oh, I don't know if he was in the party. He wasn't in the party.
I'm sure he was a bit sort of...
Yeah, no, I'm sure he always was.
I suspect that she spent time with Baruch Herzen. He's definitely...
not on.
Spent time with Baruch Herzen?
Well, knew him, sort of.
But I mean, he was around.
Yeah.
Anyway. But then you'll get more information there from the English
areas,
Gavin Williams and others. Yeah.
It's partly.
That's going to be easy.
That's not the period I'm doing. I stopped in 63.
Oh, do you really? So, because I was also going to suggest to speak to Dan Amara, but that's much later still.
Yeah, he's in Canada.
He works for Sigma.
I got his address. But I was going to go to Maputo, but I am not now. It seems a bit of an indulgence to go there because it's not where I'm located.
So you up to the end of her South African.
See, it's essentially looking at the.
I'll give you the name of the person who knew who William as in the days. That was Ruth Bourne.
Right. But this is England, I think.
Yeah,
as well. Where's Ruth?
Born.
It's born.
B-A-U-T. She was a South African girl who had a relationship, unfortunately, with a man in London, who she later married. He had a Nigerian father and a Finnish mother, and he was pursuing her, and I think she already had some idea of the relationship. It's been a good prognosis. Yes. And she came back here for about a year.
No, she worked for the Defence and Aid Fund, actually. She took over, and then you took over from Ruth.
When was that?
1960s. And in fact, she was always at those Sunday lunches at the Slovers House. And at all the parties, those parties in the city.
What do you mean by those Sunday lunches?
Ruth entertained on Sunday lunch.
Is that a standard Slovers thing?
Yes. That's where I met Winnie Mandela.
That's where I met Oliver.
God knows who else. I don't even remember. But then, so lovely. We used to sit in the garden and drink wine and eat healthy food.
Who cooked?
Well, I'm sure Ruth supervised it, but it was that the cook. Was it not cooking there?
Is that not the woman who went to Swaziland with them?
With the children in Swaziland. I remember visiting Swaziland during the emergency, and Ruth was there.
Do you know?
What year was this? 60. She was there for 3 months.
And will it show his insight?
Yeah.
Don't ask if you want to know.
I do, but not sugar.
No sugar?
No. Do you know Joe Openshaw?
Yes, I remember. I told you about him, Hill, and you'd completely forgotten about him. He writes bits and pieces in the Star, and I said to you, isn't this amazing that Joe Openshaw, you'd forgotten him. He used to go to the show because so often, that's how we know him. You just don't remember. And he did a very strange thing. He was married to this girl, I think her name was Di. And they used to come on Sundays for a swim, and Di was pregnant. And then Di had her baby, and the day she had her baby, he left her. Just disappeared. Anyway, you obviously know him. He's a journalist, so you have come across him.
I'm interviewing him tomorrow night.
About you, really. Mm. I didn't know you would, I suppose you would have.
Did he know you?
I don't know, he knew the Schoenbrookers. And Ruth works for
UH. Were ever at that Schoenbrookers, those Schoenbrookers.
No, but Ruth worked for New Age.
I think he wrote for New Age.
Joe did. Mm, I see. Mm.
But I'll find that out.
Can't place him.
A hard drink of
water. He had a kind of like a slightly seedy look. It reminded me a bit of Marius in a sense, like vulnerable, a bit seedy, a bit delicate.
Mm. He's now reports in the Supreme Court reporter.
He's done one or two nice little sketches a la Herman Bosman about the AWB and CP. Mm. It's quite clever.
Mm. Who worked on that farm labour thing with you?
Scott.
Michael Scott. Mm.
And
and the Lion of the North.
Bloke wasn't
name?
On the farm labour thing.
He was working for Drum.
Bloke made it.
But I thought he came much later, after the farm. Are you sure? Bloke starts working for Drum afterwards. After
Henry. Definitely.
Henry Kumalo was on the farm labour thing. Yeah. He's the one who exposed Bethel. Henry Kumalo was Mr. Drum. Mm,
that's right, he was.
Bloke did the expose of Christianity, brotherly love. He went to churches, often parts of English churches, and got like frog marched out of churches in the middle of a service.
I remember Black on that farm labour.
Unless he went back later. Maybe he went back later.
Where did Scott?
He did a redo. Yeah.
Where did Scott fit in? Was he?
Starts with Mary Benson. She'll tell you anything.
Well, she wrote a book about
him. To know about Marcus Scott.
Didn't you write a book about him?
About him?
Mm. There's a book about him.
Well,
who's
busy writing about
him right now? What about Lionel?
I don't think
And Marie. Not. So when did you return from England? 59?
Beginning of 60.
Because you got to know a bloke when you were in England.
What is he? This is a complete parenthesis. I've read a lot of his stuff. What was he doing in England?
He got out
of acting.
And he came there absolutely destitute.
Mm.
And
chocolates for my wife.
Blaming on history. Yes, blaming on history. Mm. Which he had a lip right next door to me. While I washed my nappies and scrubbed my floor, he would come and read me chapters of that.
Oh, really?
He was writing it. We used to fight. You've got a bloody cheek. Blame you on history, and blame me on history too. What makes you so special? They would come with all this racist stuff. He was such a terrible racist.
He's so ambivalent. I mean, to actually say that he rejected his wife because she wasn't white.
Does he say that?
That's in his book.
I don't remember that.
At the end, it just kind of tears it up.
Was he PAC?
Yes. He was, oh, yeah, so he was very critical of ANC and very keen at the book world.
Whatever happened to him?
He died.
Well, he died recently.
Very recently. Yeah. He ended up marrying some
and he's
gorgeous, blonde, sweet.
So he got his white wife in there.
Those are the contradictions of the
actually, he was such a nice person. I really loved him.
Really?
Yeah. I had an enormous fondness for him. I never, you know, afterwards lost touch with him. I saw him a couple of times when I went back to London.
I saw this lovely television program about darkest England and how these Africans, beautifully dressed, sail up the Thames into darkest England because it gets very dark in England. They arrive in North England and the princess from some African country alights and waiting to greet them, you know, are these fuzzy wuzzies, you know, sort of long, hippie people with long hair, and they're kind of staring at them like that. So she asks them to carry their luggage, and they carry beautiful baskets and things. And then she throws them a few cashew nuts and they look at the cashew nuts and the natives started murmuring, you know, they weren't happy with the pay, you know, etc. It's a whole skit, you know, missionaries arriving in England, the whole thing in reverse. And he was, it's just a skit that Blurk was in. And he tells the story. Yeah, he comes from Africa and he sails up the Thames into darkest England.
Was he in it? I mean, he's
yes, he's in it. Yeah, he acted in it. It's really
he was a real, basically, playboy at heart. That's what he was about. But he had a lot of vitality. Nice. Very
Nadine saw him about a month before he died.
Good God.
It was November 85, I think he died.
Really?
And he said in Germany, and he said, I'm so excited the revolution at last, and I'm going to go home at last. Mm. It's in sight.
And what he did died about
a month later. I can't remember.
Almost everybody on drum died of cirrhosis of the liver.
I think so.
Did
he used to drink a lot? As much as the others.
Mm-hmm.
I get the impression that he didn't.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, they all just almost consciously destroyed themselves.
Yeah.
You know, some committed suicide and others drank themselves to death. I'm surprised that he lasted so long given that he worked on drugs.
He earned some money after you're acting.
But I mean, that was one of the films that I saw on the BBC.
Oh, yes. Got good parts.
Mm.
Yeah.
What were you doing living in London?
Went to get away from this terrible country.
So did I, that's funny.
1959. It was too much to carry on living there for another minute.
How long did you last?
A year.
I beat you, I lasted 3.5.
But we had real difficulties in it because my then husband couldn't find work and I had a small baby, we had a small baby and life was really, really difficult. We really didn't have money or anything.
Your husband was a lawyer.
But he couldn't get workers in law. Mm. And he worked as a supply teacher, which was how
hellish.
Because he was trained in Roman Dutch, not English.
Right. Mm. So he worked as a cricket master. And I remember he earned something like £60. I don't know if it was a week or a month. But more than 3/4 of that went on rent. And we really were well done. So we decided we would come back here. And he would get the English exam, re-qualify, something like that.
And then go back.
And then we would return to that civilized country and wait until we could and wait for the revolution and come back. So,
and you came back and stayed.
Funny story. In fact, it's a true story. But what I was very thankful for to come back, and then I whipped for I think a solid year.
After coming back?
Yes. And in fact, it was quite funny. Bonnie reminded me the other day. We got a house. We bought a house. I mean, we borrowed 500, I don't know if it was rand or pounds.
Pounds.
Which was a vast fortune. But we borrowed it from Dennis's father. And it was Dennis pushing for this. He decided, because we had now had two children, quite soon had two children in one country, that we should have this house. And that we could always sell it and make money when we went back to England. And I was so distressed at
the implications.
I mean, of being a property owner and having a house, and I knew we'd never go, that this was it. This was the beginning of the end. And I couldn't furnish this house. We lived in this house for about 6 months without curtains and without any furniture. And it was actually Barney who one day came. He had this habit of taking people under his wing. And he said to me, "You've got to buy furniture for this place." And he said, "Come on, there's a sale on at Hill and Deleu. I'm taking you to Hill and Deleu." And
that's what the
in Gracemans, do you remember?
Yes, we thought she was expensive.
And we got this fabric on a sale, a quarter price. And there's our first. The other day, just before I got the furniture, he walked in here and he said, "I can't stand it. It's just like 100 years ago. You're living without furniture." He said, "I'm coming with you to buy furniture." I laughed. That just when he came back from overseas, he phoned me. I said, "You better come quickly and see. I've got furniture."
Have you read his book, Don Mobutu?
Yes.
Isn't it absolutely magical? It's amazing.
I don't really mean it. I still remember when he was working on that. Barney and Lionel. I remember Barney and Lionel going to visit Doug Mobutu for the last time. So it was Barney. Did Barney edit it a lot? Did he?
I think he must have, from what I've
Because I was also the whole, there's not a note that's wrong there, not a. Everything is just right. Brilliant.
He must have edited it a lot, but very sensitively. I mean, it has that the continuity of sense through it. Yeah, he gave me a copy. I'm reading it at the moment.
Yes, for the first time.
Yeah. We swapped books.
What was your book that you gave him?
The Brotherhood.
Somber sort of. Right. Sorry. Yeah.
Thanks, Lenny. Out in the rain with your parents here and no sleep last night. It's very good.
Why didn't you sleep last night?
I worked until 1. I've got a week to do. So I was going to stay 20 minutes past. I don't know if I would
do it. No. Your fax again when you're
on Friday.
Gosh, I'm going to try and pop in.
Yeah,
I really will. Take them first. The girl in Lisbon, who was Ruth's closest girlfriend at the end, last couple of years of her life, is that girl.
Who's that?
Moira.
Oh, is that Moira?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's see this.
What a wonderful pile of photographs.
Mm-hmm. And this is Hillary and Lionel Abrams and Barney.
That's Barney.
Recognize Barney.
That's Barney.
Which
like
is Barney?
Years ago. 30 years ago.
His beard sort of covers him up. No.
Who's this little girl here? That's Ruth's Bourne's little girl, Maya. The photograph of Ruth is in this. These are all sort of odd photographs. They're all in. It's here.
There were some photos of you and Ruth taken in London. Here's Jimmy.
Jimmy Vaughan. Do you remember this little girl?
No.
This was me in a kind of a crazy, wild mood. It was when they started bulldozing.
I was overseas, you told me.
They started bulldozing squatters.
Mm. Yes.
And one day, I mean, it's a long time ago.
In the early 70s. I was in England. I remember you telling me.
Oh, well, it's about 20 years ago. They bulldozed a coloured
squatter camp.
Squatter camp in the middle of winter. It was so cold.
That's when they tend to bulldoze them.
Cold. Temperatures were... And I woke up and I saw this in the newspaper and I got into a rage. It was only one can get into when one is young. I'm sure I could never get, ever have such an experience. And I got into my car in a fury and I drove 90 miles an hour out to this place. It was quite a sweater on nuclear, near our society. And I marched in there and I said, you know, I said, I invited a family to come home with me. And the people that I spoke to said that it was terribly important for them to stay together as a community. So they were going to sit it out through the winter. They were not going to, go off and take shelter. But there was one family who had about 10 kids. They had a newborn baby. And they had this girl who was being difficult, Vinette, and had a gorgeous kid. And so she came back with me and she stayed with us for ages. She didn't want to go home.
What do you mean ages?
Oh, a couple of months. Lovely little girl. We adored her. I'm going to come across it while we're talking. I just... Such a beautiful photograph. And then there's also a photograph somewhere here of Sean and Robin when they were little girls. Mm. When Ruth was in jail.
Did Ruth have curly hair?
Yes.
She had this battle with her hair. I'm sure Moira took her under her wing.
I believe in...
And then she had a natural sort of an afro cut. And it was Moira's.
Good.
Very.
She always had this... She was so well groomed.
Mm. The photographs are almost too well groomed. It needs a bit of tangle somehow. Yeah.
But it was.
Remember it was that period as well. Yeah. And she always, I mean, she was tailored and...
Mm.
Not later on.
Yeah, but in the 50s, I mean, that was my image.
So that's what I was telling Don about.
Who's this?
Yeah? About her dress designer clothes.
Mm.
That's my friend from India, from New Delhi, Sarojini. Did you ever meet her?
Mm-hmm.
Sarojini Evans, sociologist.
Mm.
She looks like Fatima Mir today. She's the most exquisite creature.
Mm. That reminds me of how time has passed.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't all look like Fatima Mir.
She said smiley.
Have you seen her?
Fatima's grown a bit.
Have you seen her?
Well, I've seen Fatima soon.
She was a pretty girl.
Yeah.
Also an activist, a young activist.
Mm. Tell me how Ruth recruited.
How Ruth, well, recruit perhaps, but we had in Davidson Pharmacy. Do you know where Davidson is? It's a
vague.
big township, like the Soweto of the East Rand. And it had just been, I think, like in 1954, 55, 56, the whole housing centralization by the state, etc., you know, getting all the black proletarians in one place.
I'm sorry, this is such an interesting thing that I've come across. You know, I told you about Hugh Leon's wife, Liz.
Yeah.
He went off to America and married and lost a child in the most horrific accident on a picnic. The kid threw a match into a barrel of petrol or something.
Mm-hmm. I didn't
this
know.
I thought it was a car accident. Mm-hmm. This is his name is Brown. He's named after Brown. Named after Brown Fisher.
And this didn't have any other children.
Terrible. Sorry.
No, just that we used to read New Age, like Nuclear Pharmacy. And then when we went to Davitton, we decided to support the newspaper and advertise Davitton cough mixture in the newspaper. So we said, we wrote to them and said, you know, send money and ask them to advertise it. And they, one day, two people came to visit us at the pharmacy, Ivan Schoenbrook and Ben Turok. They wanted to know, who are these strange
people? Were you
in any way
political before then?
Not actively so, but very sympathetic. Mm. And, but, you
what
know, I mean, I was a Greek, I'm
now?
Talking about 1958, when they came, but before that, 1956, Zach had the pharmacy, and that was the year we married. I was a student, I was very young. It was like an arranged Greek marriage, sort of semi-arranged. And I had left-wing ideas, but very unformed. And, but, you know, we developed these ideas together. And so, you know, I got Zach interested in marriage. Which I sort of came across for the first time at Nuclear Pharmacy. I have to go and visit him. Nuclear Pharmacy is an absolute, you know, it's very, very slummy. It was a part of Sophia Town, in a sense, a Western native township. Very poor. Oh, sweet. These are all our children a long time ago.
Do you know
Helene's
kids? Do you know Helene?
You don't know Helene, but I don't know.
Helene looks exactly as Lily looked.
Mm.
30 years ago, when she was a little girl.
This is 30 years ago. So they came to see us, to see who we were, you know, who these people who started the blue are advertising in the New Age. Ivan was the manager of New Age, and Benny was working for COD. He was the secretary of COD. He wasn't the secretary, sorry, Pete Bailerfeld was, but he was the secretary of the Transvaal branch of COD. So they found, I think, a very kind of naive couple, basically. But we invited them, they said, can't we come and speak to you again? And we invited them for dinner. We lived in Benoni, Davitton is outside Benoni. And they brought along Ruth and John Benjamin. You spoken to John Benjamin?
Mm-hmm.
I never talked to John. Do you know him?
Mm-mm. I didn't not one of the people you listed.
Really?
Oh,
well,
he didn't know Ruth.
He didn't, oh, not so well, but he knew her. Huh? I mean, I was just thinking that I first met Ruth and John when they first came to supper.
What happened at supper?
Nothing. They came to supper. Oh, well, we just talked, and Ruth said, I remember they talked about COD, and we were very interested, and they invited us to meetings, and Ruth said, well, you must meet Oliver. He lives nearby, Oliver Tambo, because he lived in Benoni. So she invited us to lunch. We went one Sunday and we met Oliver and Adelaide Tambo and their little girls. And we had two little girls. No, we didn't. Yeah, by the time we went there, I had had my second daughter. And Oliver had three little girls and the Slovers had three little girls. And we were making jokes about the girl manufacturers. But anyway, yeah, we met Oliver Tambo for the first time. It was quite a formal affair. And we didn't really see all that much of Ruth because she wasn't She didn't attend COD meetings. She was very busy as a journalist. Mm. And I think she was... What was her legal status? She wasn't banned yet, was she?
When
but Joe was. 59 by then. Mm. 59.
I don't know who Joe was.
Wasn't he banned? So I didn't see, I'd never had a working relationship with her at all. I became Secretary of the Defence and Aid Fund and Hillary took over from me in 62. I didn't see much of Ruth during that time, really. I'd read her articles in New Age and Fighting Talk.
That's her son. He's now 60 beautiful. And about 6 foot six.
Like his father.
Yeah.
Tall. I always found her very intimidating, really. Mm-hmm. I was very young and naive, and she was a very experienced, left-wing activist and writer.
And woman of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The only person who I've met who wasn't intimidated, who would have been safe,
is Barney.
Is Barney.
And you saw her at her vulnerable, at a very vulnerable point.
Mm.
Got to know her a bit during the emergency. Otherwise, I remember her parties. And you must talk to George Bezos. Have you spoken to George?
I haven't got to, and he's so busy.
Because they used to play bridge every Sunday night, George and Joe, and Ruth used to be very...
George and Joe and
Leviton.
Jack.
And Ruth used to just sort of sniff and say, really, you know, what... trivialities, there's work to be done, you know, and you people are playing bridge.
No, not bridge, poker.
Well, whatever it was, yeah, probably poker.
What does she like at parties?
She had a lot of energy and vitality.
She's fun.
She loved Zach, my husband, who also has still my first husband, a great deal of zest, and she used to love flirting with her, and she loved it. I mean, she responded to people who had a definite vibe or aura about them, whereas at that stage I was terribly insecure and a Greek girl and kind of pushed into a marriage, which I wasn't very happy in. What Zach and I had most in common was our politics, funnily enough. So, you know, they're just very impressions, really.
Very boring.
Isn't she?
It's long time ago.
I mean, he looks like Barney now. But you see that other one, he had his hat on.
Mm.
Ruth was in Swaziland during state of emergency when they...
This is Ruth. This is Ruth, off the picture.
Oh.
There's a picnic we went to.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, what? But there's a Ruth's feet. That's not a good thing.
Put that in your book.
Yeah?
These feet belong to an elbow.
It was a picnic we went to. I was running.
Who's that? Johnny?
Yeah.
Oh.
Managed to get what seems to be a full-run Fighting Talk.
Really?
It's from 52 to 61, 62, around there. Would that have been a fairly full run?
I don't know when it started, but that's fantastic. What about, what was the COD thing called? Did you ever come across? It was like cycle style.
Yes, I've got, I think, a fairly full run of that.
Really, I'd love to go to
Congress.
She wrote for it.
Did she write for that?
I did.
You did?
I'd like to see.
Well, it's in the Church of the Promised Library.
Oh.
You can piece it together. There's
and
some...
And Fighting Talk as well. It's banned.
Yes,
it
no.
It brought this.
No.
Take it.
Oh, lovely. Thanks.
I mean, did you have a sense that Ruth was actually a journalist? I mean, is that her main kind of thing that she did?
Yeah.
What did she do daily? You know,
she went to work. She wrote. She was a journalist. But she was very busy with, well, I mean, she was obviously doing a lot of investigative journalism.
Are you talking about 59?
I'm talking about 59, 60. I knew, I mean, my last image of her in South Africa, I was in the Afrikaner Library. It was in 1963. I was in the Afrikaner Library. I'd gone back to varsity. I was married with two children. And I looked out the window, and I looked down, and I saw Ruth. She was doing a librarianship course. She was banned. I saw her walking out, and I was just looking out the window, and I saw her walking out, and I saw two men come up and talk to her. And they talked to her for a while, and the three of them walked away together. And later that day, I heard that she'd been
detained. That was her arrest. Yeah, she'd been working in the Church of the Province.
And I've got that very clear image in my mind. Next time I saw her was in London.
She knew she was going to be detained. What she was expecting.
Why did she stay? Was Joe overseas at that point?
Yeah. You know, obviously,
it was a very,
made
very
her own independent decision.
I mean, you see, Joe left 2 months, 3 months before Ravonia.
Mm.
2 months. He went to do a little job outside to be ready to come back and take part in the triumphant entry
revolutionary
forces into Johannesburg. So he went to just fix up things outside. So,
in the bubble pot.
Oh dear. Yeah, and then, you know, for him, fortunately, I mean in personal terms, he was saved because of that. But I think that it was a time of such terrible trauma. And I think that Joe not being here, I don't think said that. But I mean, I thought that Joe not being here made Ruth feel much more vulnerable and much more unsure about what to do.
Is this after her detention? She'd come out of detention?
No, before.
No, before.
Or is this before?
Because,
is
yes, well, okay. We knew she was going to be detained. People say, go. And she knew she was going to be detained. I mean, it was obvious, it was clear. And we had even talked about, you know, made arrangements about looking after the
kids. And she was being followed. I mean, she once came to visit us, just a surprise visit. We're just going to sit down and have supper. And she arrived, and we exclaimed, and we were delighted to see her because she was in semi-hiding. And the next day, she stayed and had supper with us. And the next day, the landlord phoned us and said that we'd been away on holiday to Cape Town a month earlier. And we'd paid our rent on the 8th of the month or something. And he said, we've got to get out. We'd broken our lease and he wanted us out immediately and he wouldn't argue. And later I heard that he had been visited by the special branch.
Mm. So they were clearly
and I'm sure it's to do with Ruth's visit.
So, I mean, it's odd that she didn't leave. I suppose it's difficult with three children.
Yeah, I think that was part
the of children, it. I think the children were very insecure. But there was Tilly, you know, who was very wonderful with the children. You know, she was kind of a primary person.
Tilly must have had a very central part in bringing up the kids.
I think so. But the kids were freaked out.
I get that sense.
Ruth, of course, was very, I mean, you know, her whole Southwest Africa book. I remember her describing to us. You see, I've just got little snatches of images.
Did she go there?
Yes. She went there, and I think they served a restrict. What was this restriction order on her when she returned? But she gathered quite a lot of material. You know,
the South African served a restriction order.
Because you didn't need a passport at the time. Do you now? I don't think so. She'd flown and she'd come back and she'd be very excited and stimulated, you know, by what she'd seen and the people she'd spoken to, you know, the resistance leaders and so on. And I think she wrote quite a powerful book.
Now, did she write that when she was here?
Yes.
I don't know if she finished it when she was here. Did she start it here? Well, she did start it here. When was it published?
I'm not sure, I can check out.
Actually, I think it was published before she left.
Yeah, it was.
When did she leave, you know? 64. You should know.
63
was when she was detained.
I've got the Southeast book here.
Ah, a publication date.
So that would explain what she did as a journalist. You know, I'm trying to figure out what she did.
She's a full-time journalist. Of course, she'd also been active, for instance, she participated in the 46 miners strike as a youth, you know.
She was, of course, that
whole farm labour exposé. She also used to do things like when she was a student, she went to these youth festivals. You know, and I remember she missed her exams. I remember her telling us that she'd missed her exams because she'd been at the youth festival and how wonderful her lecturers had been, Julius Lewin.
Yeah, that is.
That's Joan in the middle.
Yeah. And that's me and a friend, mutual friend. It's in London.
She looks young.
Looks young. Right?
How old would you be then?
That was 1967.
What's
it
about 40?
Just 62 now. How old was it?
40, 41.
Ruth was very central in the work leading up to the Congress, the Cape Town Congress.
Yes.
She was on the National Executive Committee with Kachalia and Bela Fiat and Rusty Burstein.
Talk to Ben Turok in London.
And according to, I just want to confirm this, but perhaps you've heard about it, that all the demands were coming in. Ruth, as a journalist, was given the job of sifting them and getting them in what became the first draft of the Freedom Charter, after which Rusty and various other people worked on it. That's what Yusuf said.
Yeah. What I know. Did she only sort of work on the first draft?
Well, she worked on the whole thing, but her job was turning it into a charter.
Yeah. That's right.
Which is quite nice. I mean, it's an important document.
I remember Gavin Williams, who was in Oxford, saying that he became very friendly with Ruth in her English period, if you want to talk to him about it.
I've corresponded with him a lot.
I remember him saying, they're having an argument about, you know, the Soviet Union, or something or other. And Gavin said, well, you know, some of us have read the Freedom Charter, you know. And she says, yes, well, some of us wrote it. I was quite shocked and glad to say things like that. The people wrote the Freedom Charter. So somebody had to write, put it down.
Rusty wrote the call.
I've given up on that.
Shame, you've been through a great pile.
But I remember those photographs. You took them in London. Those ones. In Ruth's flat. The other room.
Mm-hmm. that? Or were you not connected to her in that way?
For me, I always thought she was a member of the CP.
No, I think she was, but I just wondered where
But that was there. I think that things changed later, but that's just hearsay. I have no evidence for it. I mean, obviously she was an enthusiastic supporter of the 46 miners strike. It doesn't automatically mean she was a member of the CP.
Yeah, I think she was. I mean, she was a member of the Communist Youth League. And Miriam says that she was almost sure she was a member of the party even while she was doing Youth League work. But
that's what I kind of assumed, but I haven't.
And I would have imagined she would have been part of the party when it was reformed in the 50s. Mm. But I'd have to ask Joe that. Or Pip Bailiffet, who was also a member.
Have you spoken to Pip Bailiffet?
I'm actually going to, I think. But I'm not sure.
Because, you know, Rob Lambert, for example. Yes. He's still in the same house in Greenside.
Good God. He was a printer.
I've heard him on tape, his voice, it's so strange, it's a Cross accent. Somebody's done a thesis, Rob Lambert, on SAC2 and interviewed him. They're long interviews and he's delighted to talk, you know. He takes him back to happier times, in a sense.
And to not be ostracized.
Yeah, I'm going to see Rob.
Rob? Yeah, I'm doing it.
What do you... I've had a sense, I've talked to lots of people about Ruth, and I get this totally different picture from different people. You know, some people tell me about this political person who was tough, scary, incisive. Other people will tell me about the professional person, meticulous journalist, the truth at all costs. And other people, very few, will tell me about this shy, private person who, when they got glimpses of that, they warmed to her tremendously, but didn't show it to many people. I mean, I think I actually put that to you. Is that a fair assessment of her, or is that...
I don't know about shy. Would you say shy? Private, yes. You know, I think there was a sense of, you know, a certain boundary.
I would say shy, I would say vulnerable. And unsure of herself. I mean, the opposite of that picture of very strong, confident, tough woman that people felt intimidated by.
That's a curious contradiction. He has this intimidating woman who's vulnerable.
Well, on a personal level, but on a professional and political level, she's, you know, very highly competent. And she was demanding of, I think, of colleagues and people who worked with her.
But what was she vulnerable to? I'm not quite sure. It's a difficult idea to take on board, given an outside image of it.
What would you say?
I think that she wasn't all that sure of herself in intimate personal relationships. I think she was very sure of herself when she was on territory that revolved around her work. But I think when it came to, you know, relating on an intimate personal level, she was, could be very unsure. She needed reassurance. And she could be soft, warm, generous, and those were the things that she valued getting.
Why do you think she was needing assurance and to come in close? Is it because, do you think, that it might have been hard to get to know Tilly as a daughter?
No, this one, as a psychologist, I'm sure that it was hard to be to Lee's daughter.
What was to Lee?
Was it dominating, formidable, laying down the law?
But Ruth had this enormous, I mean, her whole illness was also another remarkable thing, the way she conquered her. I suppose you know the whole story.
I really don't.
You know, when she was a child.
Yeah, she had some.
And she had some glandular thing, and she just fought against herself and built up such reserves of self-discipline until they found medication, you know, that worked. But she had this tendency to get very, very tired and would sleep for long periods, and she just forced herself, she'd sort of drag herself to school and force herself to do her work and do well, and you know, that was the kind of foundation, or kind of character formation. I don't know.
Do you know what it was?
I don't know when it was, but I think she was quite small, you know, like from 8 onwards. Don't you know about it? Do you know about it?
I know about it, but like you're
not aware. She had a thyroid.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah. And she put on a lot of weight and get very, very sluggish, and it distressed her terribly. You know, she wanted to be, you know, attractive and in control and in command. And that sort of shaped her character together with Tilly. I mean, heaven knows what Tilly was doing to her when she was going through this, you know, this period until medication was found. And you know, that's also part of the whole thing of her impeccable grooming and never putting on weight, you know, and being very careful about how she looked, her hair. She had, you know, her hair was always just not a hair on her face. Control, right.
But she laughed at herself in later years. I mean,
so she was much more sure and relaxed, sure of herself.
And the last time I saw her, she talked about the clothes, shrieking with laughter. She described her outfits and matching accessories. He said, I just can't believe that was me. Absurd.
And I mean, there is a contradiction in a sense. And she was this very, in a sense, quite a puritanical Marxist, you know. And yet she needed all these bourgeois trappings.
That I find fascinating.
Yes.
She even had a fur coat.
Yeah, she's always expensively dressed, you know. You can see in photographs.
Do you know when the cure was found? I mean, do you have any idea?
I don't. I think she was in her when she was about 12 or 13. I wish I could remember how I know this, but I can't.
And I wonder where on earth I could ever confirm that.
Gerald. Teddy, wouldn't Miriam or others who knew her as a young girl?
Miriam knew her at the Jewish government school, still at 5.
Would she have been there?
Might be.
I'm sure she would have been there.
She was quite a fat, sluggish little girl, and she just fought, you know, all the way. Must have been incredible will that she developed.
When she left the country, did she leave her wardrobe?
I don't know.
I mean, it must have been very cathartic in a way, and so a little bit scary in a way to just, I mean, it would be for anybody going into exile. But in her case, probably knowing that she's not coming back for quite a while. Did she have that sense that she wasn't coming back?
Oh, yes.
There was a sense that the revolution had kind of, you know...
She was...
It's going to take another decade.
They sold all their furniture.
The house was sold after they'd left, I think.
I don't remember, but I remember we took quite a lot of their furniture.
And the girls? They followed afterwards.
I can't remember anymore quite how it worked. But I remember mother, you know, soon after they got to London, they bought this house in Lime Street, which I think one of the girls in Shawmut lived in it, in Camden Town. But when they first bought it, they did it up beautifully.
I remember their navy blue bathroom.
When it was still new, it was exquisite. I'd never seen a house like that in South Africa or London. I mean, I couldn't get over it. Just thought it was incredible. She has good taste.
Mm. It must have cost us money to do that.
Oh, they have money.
They have money, but also English houses were cheap, you know. You had to buy property for cash, and then have the cash. 5,000-6,000 pounds.
It was so beautifully furnished. It was exquisite, that house.
I believe it's
terrible now. Very run down, very shabby. I think Sean might live in. Yes, Sean lives in.
There'd be a flat downstairs too.
That's where Tilly lived. It was also very nice.
Was Ruth scared of leaving?
Look, she travelled a lot.
But permanent
she put
leaving.
So much, yeah, I mean, she just invested so much of her life, you know, in South Africa, I don't know.
I think they got very involved very quickly in establishing a new life.
A new base.
I mean, and they were, you know, I mean, they were very different people from some of the exiles who really had tough times. For example, someone like Esmé Goldberg never forgave Ruth for being this queen and just trampling on the lights of, you know, small fry like Esmé. Yeah.
In London.
Yes, boy, did she have it in. And there were quite a number of people, you know, who had it really tough time.
Also critical.
Who really did miss home and who did struggle and did have nothing. Who I think were enormously envious of the slavers.
Why did they do it so well, the slavers?
Well, I suppose money helped.
A lot of people had money.
Ruth had flair.
Her
standards.
She had an ability to get things done, to get things together.
And it was important to have sort of habitable and aesthetic surroundings. She just felt that, you know, then you could function properly.
Not later on. Her place in Maputo was a long way from
was it
her
a flat.
Yes, it was a flat. And then after she died, Joan moved to a sort of a house.
In Maputo.
Yes, no one knew where he stayed. And they had a lot of the things that I remembered from the flat and from, not from here, from London, odd pictures. But I mean, yeah, that place in Maputo was a long, long way from the house in Victory Park. You know, something of these.
Not Victory Park. Northcliffe.
Victory Park.
Victory Park.
Up here.
Victory Park.
Yes,
Montgomery.
So I mean, one gets a sense from that as they matured as people, they needed less of the trappings and the flair and the established externals. But that might be.
I don't know if Joe needed it. Joe was much more relaxed.
Joe wouldn't have had any.
Laid back. He's very laid back.
Ruth did it all. It was Ruth. It wasn't Joe. And Joe, of course, had never had any money. He had money. But when he went into London, he was working For nothing. I mean, for pocket money. So.
And would Julius and Tilly have been supporting him? What happened at the factory? Julius had to leave. Ravonia was in his name, wasn't it? Or certainly he did most of the...
It was. Ravonia was in Watchfulit's name. Arthur Geldrath.
But Julius had done a lot of
the... Yes, he did the finances. He was the bookkeeper.
And he left. He went into hiding, didn't he?
He did. But if I did know the details of that, I've certainly forgotten them. But I mean, there would be people who would know that quite intimately. Harold would know.
Tilly followed Ruth, in a sense, didn't she? And Julius was out already.
And Ronnie? Have you spoken to him?
I haven't, no.
He doesn't want to.
I've got a rather cold shoulder. I mean, well, he wouldn't give me access to Tilly. So I doubt whether he'd talk to me. But I will try, actually. He's the only person who can tell me about it.
But was it, how much younger?
4 years.
He was the bookkeeper of the Defence and Aid Fund. They used to come to meetings. I don't know if he still
did
was
he?
When
he
was.
I don't remember that.
We used to come to meetings and report on the accounts and everything.
So how did the parents, they had money here, but how did they survive in London? Do you know that? Or did they just, the factory carried on here?
I don't think they cut off,
maybe Ronnie, I don't know, maybe Ronnie ran the factory.
Ronnie ran the factory.
Well, maybe they got the money out of it, but they certainly had money to begin with. Certainly. Although, I don't think they ended up with money. Because I think Ronnie looks after Tilly.
He pays for everything.
Where does Tilly live now?
Stays in a very nice place that belongs to Ronnie's wife.
Really?
In Killarney. Just on Rivera Road, just near the shop. Sort of a townhouse in a corner of this huge block. It's nice.
Tilly said to me, "What happened to Ronnie?" I said, he's here, he's in Joe. No, I mean, what happened to him? What went wrong? Why is he just... He doesn't read, he's got books he doesn't read. He's got a head he doesn't think. He just makes money. No, what's wrong with Ronnie?
It's his rebellion against his parents.
It's fascinating.
Just suddenly out of the blue in the middle of something else.
And poor Ronnie. I mean, that whole family must have been such a hard act to follow. He was the youngest, you know.
What was Julius like? Is he also high-flying?
Well, I'm sure he's part of the complexity of the family, you see. I think he was...
Did you know him?
I used to meet him in those...
What was he like?
Gentle. That's a typical picture, you see, of a
gentle Jew.
Impact husband. I think Tilly ruled the rest, and I suspect that Julius might have been... slightly scared of her.
Did she dominate intellectually as well, politically?
Except Julius got into politics before she did.
He was older than her.
But I think that they came probably in a similar way to Ruth and Joe. I think that Julius was not born in this country, was he? So Julius was a foreigner, come from a tough school. And he was very much linked into a generation of Jews who were communists because communism would liberate Russia from the anti-Semitic Tsars. You know, I mean, it was something of that. Background. I mean, all Jews were communists. I mean, anyone who could think and take a political stand, they were all sympathetic to the revolution. They all believed in it. New world, well, in which the Jew would be free.
But even Zionism would be socialist.
Zionism was socialist. Yeah. All the big Zionists, all the important Zionists were socialists.
And the emphasis either on class or nationalism.
I mean, there were tensions. I think there was a different focus. The tensions came later.
In the 30s.
And Tilly was different.
But Tilly, I think, I'm not sure, but she wasn't born in this country, but she came to this country very early on. And I think she grew up in, you know, fairly comfortable circumstances, and she was well educated, and I don't know.
That's a left